Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Jesus. Welcome to the Completely Unnecessary Podcast for Wednesday, February 1st, 2017. I was Pat Contry at one point in time. What do we got going on in the show today? Oh, we'll be talking about the GameStop program where they officially lie to customers about what games they have in stock. The passing of the founder of Namco. We'll also be discussing Neo Geo counterfeits in an article from the New Yorker. Nintendo Switch having a Super Bowl commercial? Yay, marketing! And other topics that are going on in the world of retro and modern games and me barely being here. No, I'm all right. Just real busy. But real quick, though, an update on Ian. His health is still not the best. In terms of updates, you can follow him on Twitter at PixelSickle. But, you know, I can say that there has not been much sort of change in the status. He's still doing tests, have to get those tests looked at by the specialist. There's incompetent people, don't know how to fucking fax stuff back and forth between offices in a timely manner. That's basically the short and the pretty much, the short and the long of it, actually. So if you want to help him out and also to stay up to date on what's going on, go to thepunkeffect.com/Ian, and that will redirect to his GoFundMe, and you can keep track of what's going on there. So what's been going on in Pat's world? Well, I've been helping prep for this event I'm helping put on, the SoCal Retro Gaming Expo. That's February 4th and 5th in Ontario, California. Lots of cool YouTubers are going to be there. It's interesting going to conventions for years and years and years. I mean, my first convention that I was a guest at was, Jesus Christ, Screw Attack Gaming Convention. That was 2010, so it's been almost 7 years. I've been here 7 years. Interesting to be a guest at so many on that side and then actually try to put them on. And it's about what you expect. There's a lot of, not drama, but a lot of ins and outs. A lot of stuff you got to plan for, look out for, little hiccups. But it's going to be a fun time. Frank's going to be there. You're going to have guys like Andre Meadows of Black Nerd Comedy there. You're going to have Billy and Jay Game Chasers, Pro Jared, Gerard the Completionist, my pal Gerard, who helped out with the NES Marathon. You're also going to have Phil Moore from Nick Arcade. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Dozens of arcade games and tournaments and consoles, and I'll be there hawking my wares. So go to SoCalRetroGamingExpo.com for more information and tickets. If you want to save before they get to the door, you want to rush on in to buy those games, you don't want to wait with the other humanoids, you buy the tickets early and use promo code NESPUNK to save on your tickets there. Other than that, the Ultimate NES Game Guide app is out for both iOS and Android. Android. Can I just say Android? But it's really Android, not Droid. What? Anyway, so, and version 1.1 is out. 1.2 is on the way. We have this sucker specced out to like 1.5. Because you know what? We're not going to be like those other apps out there that, you know, never update. No, there's a lot of stuff planned for the next few months for the app. But 1.1 is a pretty good spot. 1.2 is going to be like the really holding it down. But 1.1 is pretty much where I wanted it to be when it first launched. But a little behind. We're catching up with me and Embraceware working together. So go to ios.ultimatenes.com. And if you're on your iPhone, that'll pop up to the store. You can purchase it there for the nominal fee of $4.99. But yeah, there's no DLC. There's no microtransactions. There's nothing like, well, you only can look at 14 games a day before you got to buy more game views for a dollar. No, we don't have that in the app here. You know, we don't have that stuff going on. And then the Android one's at droid.ultimatenes.com. And if you're on a computer or your app, you're on your phone, not your app, you're on your Google phone,
Google, not Google phone, your Android device. Is there Google phones anymore and Windows phones? Anyway, well, there's Google phones, I guess, but it's Google Play Store. Anyway, so that address will bring up the app for you to buy, is what I'm trying to say, because I'm starting off on an awful foot of this podcast. My head's already swirling with things I have to still do. So speaking of cool stuff, though, by the time you listen to this, an NES Punk episode will be out. The NES Punk, and it's a look at the NES Classic Edition and all its games. And it's 28 minutes long. Holy God. So check out that video. Please retweet and share my NES Punk videos, since they don't really support themselves in terms of finances, in terms of the time put into them versus how many people see them. It's sort of that age-old dilemma. You like doing them, but you know, when something takes you 60 hours to do and you really don't get paid for those hours, it's kind of hard to constantly be putting time towards it, which is, again, why people say, why can't you do one of these every month? Well, that means I can't work on stuff that actually would get me money to live and survive and to, you know, make myself happy in life. So that's the thing. Yeah, I can do a Pat Daniels Punk video every week if I wanted to, but I'd be miserable. And, you know, I'd have to go back to work. You know what I used to do? I used to be a hangman's gallows man. Yeah, that's what I used to be back in the old West. What am I talking about? I'm not starting off well. I have a very, you know, very dark, humorous little anecdote about a job that's the only job I could think of was that hangman's gallows guy. Is that even the executioner? Is that a more proper term there? Is that really the only job I can come up with? There's probably literally hundreds of thousands of jobs that I could have probably thought of. School teacher, doctor, lawyer. And any one of those sitcom jobs you see out there, usually half of them are lawyers, the other half are doctors. But I picked a fucking executioner, someone that puts a noose around someone's neck in the Old West. That's just is that Freudian or Jungian or where did I just go there? I'm out of my goddamn mind. This is before the podcast even starts. Jeez. So anyway, and speaking of ramblings of a madman. I will have plans to start up the PatCast. I'm not sure that's going to be the final name. That's the working title, which will be my non-gaming podcast. And that's going to probably happen, I don't know, look out for it by March, maybe before. I got to take a freaking break. That's all I know. I got to take a break after the SoCal Retro Gaming Expo February 4th and 5th in Ontario, California. So GameStop. Dirty, dirty GameStop and their lies. And their lies. It's always funny to me whenever there's a GameStop article about any topic at all, whether it's the Retro Game Initiative, new stuff, pre-orders, there's always at least two or three people in the comments that say either, I used to work at GameStop and it's shit, I still worked at GameStop and it's shit, I was a manager who worked at GameStop, or I'm currently a manager who works at GameStop and they're shit. And of course, all these people say on the boards, and no one's disputing it, that employees aren't treated properly, their hours get cut, they're forced to push the GameStop award programs in the magazine, you know, and that goes back to, that's not even a recent thing, that's 15 years pushing their magazine and subscribing to the award program and stuff like that. And they're not even called managers anymore at GameStop, they're leaders, and customers are, what are customers called? Are they called players or walking piles of cash? What is the official name? They're not allowed to call customers. Anyway, since it's been a while since we spoke about anything GameStop related on the podcast, there's a great new topic that it's not shocking to hear this. That according to, this is a Kotaku article by Jason Schreier, who's one of the more respectable guys on Kotaku, if there are any. He's, I guess, one of them. New GameStop program leads employees to lie to customers. And they called this program the Circle of Life. It's the Circle of Life and lying to your customers that we're not calling customers. So there's quotas at GameStop, individual stores for pre-orders, reward card subscriptions, which we knew that, use game sales and game trade-ins. There's a certain mark you're required to hit or else you're going to get a browbeating and or eventual firing. And I'm guessing individual employees, besides the not manager leader, also have these same goals they have to hit while they're working there. All right, makes sense? So, Pre-orders and reward card subscriptions are based on the total number of transactions, which means that, you know, if there's 1,000 transactions in a month, there's a percentage of those you have to hit. So say the sell-through rate has to be at least 10%. You got to sell at least 100 of those bad boys out of 1,000, or else, you know, you're in trouble, you know. So if a store's quota for used game sales is 30% and the store sells 1,000 worth of merchandise, GameStop expects at least 300 of that merchandise to be pre-owned. All right, so they have that too, besides, you know. They're tracking all this shit. It's a corporation. It's traded. It's publicly traded. All right. So if someone, I'm just plagiarizing word for word here, but whatever. So if someone walks into GameStop and picks up, say, a brand new copy of Yakuza, without pre-ordering another game, subscribing for a new rewards card, buying a used game, or trading in some games to help pay for it, then the transaction will knock down all four percentages. And this isn't even a secret at all. When you walk in the GameStop, it's like a 10-minute process to buy a game because they got to look up your current account. They ask if you want to pre-order anything that's on their list. Do you want the subscription? Do you have the rewards card? I think I have the rewards card actually laying around somewhere. So there you go. So, but this is the new part of this deal that you're going to have everyone ranting and raving about. With Pat, at least, you get the more level-headed, not everything's the end of the world perspective. Even though stuff is still shitty, you don't have to go jump off the nearest bridge when you hear the stuff from good old Pat. Because I don't have the energy. I'm getting old. So this was an email from an anonymous worker to Kotaku who stated this. But GameStop is, according to this, incentivizing employees to stop people from buying new games and hardware. And that just goes beyond pushing used games or trade-ins. Now we're just going to stop people from buying the stuff we have in stock. GameStop staff say the company has threatened to fire people who don't hit their quotas, which leads to these sort of tactics. I mean, if someone wants to come in and buy a game and you have a used one or a new one, and it actually hurts you, it hurts your store's quotas to sell the new one, then you're going to send them away until you can sell that used one. It's insane to think about, but that's what's going on. In quotes from the person that emailed, "We are telling people we don't have any new systems in stock, so we don't take a $300 or $400 hit on our pre-owned numbers. This is company-wide and is in discussion with my peers. And in discussion with my peers, it is common practice. We also tell customers that we don't have copies of new games in stock when they are for sale. For example, Watch Dogs 2 is currently $299 new and $54.99 pre-owned. We just tell them we don't have the new one in stock and shuffle them out the door. The Circle of Life program, which began late last year but ramped up in early 2017, according to staff, attaches a specific COL score to each employee and store. Each of the four categories represents 25% of that total COL score." The four categories being the rewards program and pre-orders and trade-ins and blah, 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 blah. And used games. So, wow. So you're in trouble if you don't hit this goal at your individual store. You have to get at least a 75% hit on 3 of the 4 quotas. And if a store is hitting their targets but one salesperson is not, that salesperson may face punishment or even lose their job. This is fantastic, but is it a shock? I mean, the margin that GameStop makes on new games is nowhere near what they're making on trade-ins and in used game sales. So if you compare a $50 new game, GameStop might be making, I don't know, not even $10 on that? Is it even that? Is there someone out there with more knowledge? The margin isn't great on this stuff for new games. It just isn't. But on used games, a $50 used game, that was traded in, and GameStop probably gave you like $15, $20. That's $30 profit. So you're talking, it doesn't really matter to them as much for these new games sales in comparison to the trade-in business. It just doesn't. It's so much harder for them to make it up. That's why they want to push. Like Twilight Zone, push the trade-ins and used game sales. It just makes business sense, but it's shitty that you're going to lie to your customers. Absolutely shitty. So now to work at GameStop, to be a leader, or even a regular employee, you have to actually have no ethics anymore. You know, it's not even what the customer's always right. Now it's the customer, we can just lie to them. The customer's always getting bullshitted to. That's the new slogan that Pat comes up to in 2017. You know, that's what we got here. A quote from this anonymous source. The other day, working the Resident Evil 7 Kingdom Hearts launch, we were telling walk-in customers, non-reserve customers, that we didn't have the games in stock or that they were only for pre-orders in order to not sell new copies of games. It's that bad. So they'd rather make less profit then, some profit, but not a huge amount, to then hopefully have those people, hopefully they come back or get a used copy a week later so they can meet their goals. It's insane. But I don't doubt that this is true. And people and down in the comments that have knowledge or have worked for GameStop say this type of stuff happens. A second employee found themselves in trouble after selling a bunch of new games last Tuesday during the launch of Resident Evil 7, Kingdom Hearts, and Tales of Berseria. They quoted, "Now I'm fucked for the week. Now I have to sell way more pre-owned this week." They gotta make up. It's not even... You can't overly sell new games, and then you gotta make it up with pre-sale. So you could be the best GameStop salesman in the world at selling new games and still making the company profit, but because you have this weird percentage quota system for pre-sale games and for used games and trade-ins, you can still be browbeaten or punished or fired because you're not selling enough to make up for all the new games you're selling. It's that crazy. That crazy. This is crazier. It's almost as crazy as Second and Charles talk at this point. Man. Woo! I really feel for you GameStop employees out there. You're trying to do the good thing. You want to enjoy video games, so why not work around it, right? That makes perfect sense. I applied for Funko Land back when I was like 16, 17 years old. I know what's up. But then you're faced with this corporate bullshit that where you have to actually lie to customers or else you're going to be without a job within a few months probably. I mean, that terrible. Terrible. I don't understand it. I don't understand why you think GameStop Corporate, this is a good strategy. Don't you just want to push sales overall? And how about instead of punishing, you have some sort of reward program for your individual stores that do well and for the individual employees? Make that a bonus. It's always good positive reinforcement, not negative. Don't spank your kid for not doing all the trade-ins that you wanted them to, but reward them with a lollipop when they do. Well, how about that? Sort of a sad day when you talk about the passing of someone in the video game industry that really left their mark, but it's also a celebration of their life. When Ralph Baer passed a few years back, it was a celebration. It was good to see the internet and the video game fans in general come out and, you know, really honor the legacy of someone. So, the passing of Masaya Nakamura, who founded Namco, Ian's favorite video game company, and one of the most important video game companies ever. I tweeted out, you could not imagine the landscape of video games now without Namco, because they were so influential. A little bit about the man himself. So, Masaya Nakamura, looks like he got involved with some sort of shipbuilding he studied after World War II, and then started Namco. I did not know this. Like the mechanical horses, you put like a quarter in and you ride on them. That's how Namco started. That's what they originally did. And they developed those little, you know, I guess coin-operated mechanical devices and little rides. And then when the video game fad it was in the late 70s came about, you know, hey, let's start doing that. Let's have an arcade division. Why the hell not? You know, Space Invaders blew it up in Japan. You know, you had these arcades popping up. And so good old Masaya said, I want to do that. I want to start an arcade division and I want to develop things internally. And that's what they did. And thankfully so. Thankfully so. Thankfully that happened. Because if you want to remember, I wasn't there, but this is what everyone says and this is all the evidence and... Pat, you weren't alive then! Prior to 1980, in particular, arcades, and this is, we talk about this in the video game years, historians say this, and it's a truth. When you look at pictures of them,
actual pictures. Arcades before the 1980s and the 70s were dark. They were dingy because they were mainly adult-oriented, focusing primarily on males. Go ahead and take a look at arcade games, like a list of arcade games, and look at arcade games that came out in the 70s prior to 1980 and prior to one game in particular that we'll get to. They were, for the most part, very simple games. You had a lot of breakout clones or pinball sort of games. You had single-screen war games, games that emulated life more than what they would become. Simple games like, I think that Gremlin put out a game where you're a frog going around. Well, not life for humans, but life for a frog. That's, you know, a fishing game. Obviously, you had a shit ton of Space Invaders clones after Space Invaders came out. So you had like those shoot the aliens single screen games. You had some simple sports games like those Atari basketball game. You had Sprint. You know, you had those simple racing games. You had Monaco GP. These were games that were directed and marketed and created for a very specific market for each of them. And a lot of those games didn't have massive wide appeal. The Namco games sort of changed that. And when you look at the Namco games, before the big one, they were sort of tiptoeing towards that. The biggest one being in 1979, Galaxian. Colorful. Had a little bit of first for video games, top of my head. You had a little ditty, a little song before the round. That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool if you didn't hear that in a game before. Like, oh, what is that? Oh, some personality, some life there. You know, wasn't just monochrome. You had multiple colors there. Hey, this is something. This is something. I'm not saying this is everything, but this is something to start from. But then once you hit 1980, you know, all bets are off. Obviously, you have the big one. You have Pac-Man. Comes out May 1980. Revolutionizes not just arcades. Revolutionizes video games in general. Because here you have a video game in Pac-Man that is colorful. It's cute. It has the first mascot in video games. The first real IP you could mass market. Appeal to men, women, boys, girls, everyone. It sort of redefined what an arcade game should be. It wasn't just some, you know, some war game that some 45-year-old guy could enjoy. Anyone can play Pac-Man. It's simple. It's easy. It also helped establish the maze genre, which for the next few years you had all. I mean, that if you had the Space Invaders clones of the late 1970s and the early 80s, you had all the maze games, which is a fine genre. It obviously got played out within a few years, but the maze genre is very important for games because it took the single-screen game and made it more complex versus just, all right, let's cast our fishing rod and hope that a fish eats it on the screen. Now you incorporate movement on a single screen at least. So you still have the limitations of a single screen, but you can do more with the maze game. I mean, just looking at it, just technically. Colors, the sounds, you have a... Really, one of the first times you have a little cutscenes in a game, telling a story with actual characters in a game, and again, it appeals to everyone, and it blew up. It blew up in the pop culture. First time you have all these toys and cartoon shows and a freaking hit a single based on a video game. It's insane to think about what the landscape would have looked like had Namco not sort of just punch the industry in the gut and say, all right, get up, look at this now. This isn't just your monochrome, you know, Space Invaders clone number 78. This is something called Pac-Man that anyone could play, and we're going to fucking dominate with this game, and this will be the most recognizable video game character for a long, long, long-ass time. Besides Crash Bandicoot. Oh, no, we got Pac-Man. So, that's important. And obviously, Namco, after that, faltered a little bit, but they got back up there in the mid-80s. After putting out, like, 47 different Pac-Man games, they decided, you know, they branched out a little bit more.
Namco purchased Atari Games in the mid-80s. That was important. They established Tengen to really go after Nintendo directly, and that was important. Whatever side you were on, the monopolistic practice of the NES should have been challenged by some third party, and I'm glad Tengen did that, and eventually that opened the door to more third-party development and Nintendo dropping their draconian policies, well, they're forced to in a lawsuit, on other systems. And especially when once you got to the Genesis, the practices were out the window. Nintendo could no longer strong-arm a company to say, okay, only come out with games on our system and not the competitors. That was gone by then. But you needed a company like Tengen to challenge the monolithic Nintendo practices at the time. So that's important, too. And obviously, in modern days, you have Namco, Bandai. They still put out games. They haven't fallen off completely. Obviously, they're not as big as they were in the early 80s, but they're still a very important company. You know, the biggest games that they still put out, Tekken's freaking huge, and they have a bunch of other games as well. My favorite arcade game, Rolling Thunder, Namco, right there. I forgot about Galaga, too. Was Rally X 79 or 80? That one I kind of always forget. Rally X was also 80. So, Galaga was 81. All right, so Galaga was after Pac-Man. But Rally X, at the time, some people in the industry thought that Rally X was going to be the big hit and not Pac-Man, which is just, that's just interesting to me that you could sort of, and you see that sometimes with other industries, they predict one big thing. Betamax is going to be better than VHS. Uh-uh. Didn't work out that way. The Zune was going to be better than the iPod. Well, no one thought that. So look at these, the lineup, though, just in 80 and 81. In 82, that helped just, again, sort of open up video games to this mass market. Galaxian sort of paved the way a little bit. But then you have Pac-Man, Rally X, Miss Pac-Man, and I won't go into the other Pac-Mans, but they were fairly popular, but Miss Pac-Man was huge. Galaga, Bosconian, is sort of a underlooked early arcade game. Dig Dug, Zevius, Pole Position in 82. Mappy in 83, Tower of Druaga, I say Dig Dug. So, you just have all these titles that you can't imagine the arcade scene or video games in general without the influence of those 8 to 10 games. Like, if you walked into any arcade, I'd say between 80 and 83, you are guaranteed to see at least one Pac-Man game of some sort, and probably at least one or two other Namco games. Probably almost guaranteed to see a Galaga game, at least one Pac-Man game, and probably, you know, we'll throw in like a Dig Dug or a Pac-Man Plus or a Super Pac-Man or a Mappy, you know, one of those others. So just a great company. It's a shame that Ian's still not feeling well, because he could have probably just, you know, he probably would have been either just gloating over the fact that, oh, I love Namco, or he'd be so sad he'd go, you know, he'd be unhealthy again from the pain of the founder of Namco, the father of Pac-Man, Masaya Nakamura. And I say that because there were many articles that, in the headline and in the article, in quotes, the father of Pac-Man, Masaya Nakamura. Because he led the company that birthed Pac-Man, and he was the one that decided, hey, I want to have arcade games, and these are the arcade games I want to try to do. This is sort of, you know, he set up the environment. And according to reports, that name was given to him by Namco, because they recognized, hey, this is sort of the father of Pac-Man. He's the father, basically the father of the company. Is when you're saying the father of Pac-Man, you're also saying he's the father of Namco, which he was. Because now Namco and Pac-Man are synonymous with each other. You cannot think of one without the other. It's the mascot. It's one of the most popular video game mascots of all time. It's the most important video game of all time, Pac-Man. So some people decided, though, they were going to get offended by this term for some strange reason. It was really strange for me. It'll be the first and last time you'll probably ever see the white knighting of Toru Iwatani, the actual developer and programmer of Pac-Man. People saying, tweeting and getting angry about, oh, how dare you not say that Nakamura is the father of Pac-Man, it was Iwatani. Even though every fucking article I saw where he was, in quotes, the father of Pac-Man, also made it note to say that Iwatani was the actual creator of Pac-Man. So it's not like Iwatani is getting cheated out of his day in the sun. Don't worry, when he passes away in 20 years, you can go honor him. But let's be honest for a second here. You are not upset about this, really. You probably didn't know, and this is a general you, how many of you out there that were pissed that some articles quoted, in quotes, called Nakamura the father of Pac-Man, knew Toru Iwatani's name, or really gave a shit about Pac-Man at all before that opportunity to do your tweets and to go after, you know, some of these websites. It was both mind-boggling and one of the dumbest fucking things I've ever seen in my life. One of the biggest wastes of time you can probably do is to, instead of honoring a great man's life who started this gigantic company and one of the pioneers of the video game industry itself, instead of honoring him, you're going to be fucking worried about a nickname that was given to him, reportedly from Namco themselves. That's how you choose to use your energy when the rest of the world wants to simply honor what sounds like a really cool individual. After the Namco Bandai merger, he still was there in an honorary position. Lived a great life. Was he 91 years old? Father of Pac-Man? Sure, why not? Iwatani probably doesn't give a shit. That's his nickname. Why should you? That's all I'm saying. Just one of the silliest things I've seen in a while. That's all. Oh yeah, this is one thing I didn't know. I'm glad this stuff came up. So Namco is an acronym. I didn't know that. This is great. It's not great that he died, but it's great that I found this out after he died. Nakamura Amusement Machine Manufacturing Company. So NAM and then CO for company. Namco. Holy shit. The guy's name. Nakamura Namco. He is the father of Pac-Man. He's got to be. Speaking of the father of Pac-Man, we have the killer of Pac-Man. The What's Inside channel, a channel that I thought was a parody account at first. I thought I stumbled on some sort of Onion channel, but no, it's a real YouTube channel. It's real. Oh, it's real. Where this has 4 million subscribers, and it consists of a guy literally breaking and tearing apart various objects to show you what's inside them. Now, I believe there is some sort of cable show where this idea was probably aped from, where they take like huge buzz saws and like will saw a car in half and things like that, which is entirely dumb. Those guys, though, probably have some knowledge of the inner workings, at least, or have experts on to really explain the intricacies. From what I've gathered from watching, unfortunately having to watch a few of these videos on this What's Inside channel, they just destroy shit for the sake of it and tell you absolutely nothing about it other than what your own eyes can see. They're not experts at all. This guy has no idea what he's talking about. He brings his kid along for the ride, probably to make himself look better on screen. I'm not just some middle-aged asshole destroying stuff for no reason. I got a kid involved too, so it's educational. That said, they tore apart a Pac-Man cabinet, a vintage Pac-Man cabinet that was converted via the ROM board and the marquee header to Miss Pac-Man, but it was a Pac-Man cabinet in decent condition for a 37-year-old cabinet. In decent condition, the monitor had a little bit of screen burning, as you'd expect from a Pac-Man machine that's 37 years old, which they then promptly destroyed that perfectly working monitor. But the machine worked fine, though. They actually played the machine beforehand. All right, so they destroy a Pac-Man machine with this guy uses a jigsaw. I'm gonna click on some of his videos so I remember off the top of my head. He uses a jigsaw, uses I think a crowbar to tear it apart. Magnanimously, they say, "Oh, we're gonna keep some parts. We're gonna keep like the side wood, and they're basically gonna keep half of it. They're gonna keep the two pieces of side art attached to the two sides. They're gonna keep the overlay glass. They're gonna keep the glass marquee." So they're basically keeping a chunk of it. And the ROM board they're going to keep.
This is upsetting, though. Obviously, it's upsetting. Because anyone watching this would die for a vintage arcade machine like this. This is not a cheap machine. This isn't like I'll be bitching about, oh, there was this beat up old, you know, I don't know, a PlayChoice 10 that was absolutely decrepit and falling apart. Even that's gone up in value. So that's not even a good example. But it's not some random machine that's on its last legs. It works. And it's a machine that even in that condition will go for probably close to $1,000. The arcade auction, the auctions, let alone eBay, the auctions I went to, the last ones I went to probably 7 years ago, you would get beat up Miss Pac-Man machines going for $1,000 or more, or beat up Pac-Man's going for that much. Because while there's a lot of them out there, still, not as many as that were out there 40 years ago. A lot were destroyed. It's not like you can walk down the street and find them, and it's the most popular game. So people want these. They want them to either own and play them or to restore them to like new condition. And that's why they go for a lot of money. I mean, hell, I can check on eBay right now. While I comment on more about the prices of these. Let's fuck it. Pac-Man Vintage Arcade. I'm just going to see what the going rate is for this. If you want to get a restored one, you're going to look at $2,000. You want to get a beat up one? Yeah, $900 for a Miss Pac-Man. A new commercial one will cost you $2,000. These are coveted. These are definitely coveted. A multi-K converted, $1,500, buy it now. Obviously, your miles may vary on this. He could have got this locally for a lot less. But the fact of the matter is, this is a coveted machine. You're storing it for no good reason. I thought it was humorous that within the first 2 minutes of the video, he smiles and says, "We found the Midway Pac-Man parts and operating manual." And he quickly looks at it, "Oh, we're going to keep this." You know what was in that manual? Instructions about how to open the machine without destroying it. You know, like the latches and the door in the back so you can actually get in there. Get at the board, you know, take the monitor in and out, you know, stuff like that. You know, the coin door in the front, you can quickly get that rekeyed if you want to open the coin door up and look at the coin there. The whole point is, obviously, you can know what's inside a fucking arcade machine by either looking at pictures online, looking at the freaking operating manual in his hand, or by actually opening the machine up without destroying it, you can easily learn what's in there. And it's not a huge, huge amount of parts either. It's not like opening up, you know, a computer necessarily, even though it has some of the, you know, you got a ROM board, you got your monitor. But it's not like this is like so intricate that the only way we would have known what was inside of this was by cutting the fucking thing in half or just destroying it entirely. That's what's so silly about this. What's even sillier, though, is that this channel actually exists, which means I have no faith in humanity, since they think that learning means watching some fool destroy stuff for no good reason. That's how they want to learn. What's more discouraging, though, is that there are actual channels out there with people that actually have knowledge of the items that this guy's destroying who are not getting any views. And yeah, woe is me. One guy's getting all the views and attention, other people aren't. But it's just, to me, just, I don't know, is Rome burning now? That we think learning is watching a guy destroy stuff. Unless you're out there, you actually get some sort of satisfaction to see some guy destroy a lot of times perfectly good stuff. In this case, a perfectly fine Miss Pac-Man machine in a Pac-Man cabinet. Like, if you think that's fine, good on you. You're probably not listening to this podcast, though, because that's not the audience I cater to. But yeah, there's arcade channels out there, people that restore machines. If you want to learn about arcade machines and the inner workings of how they work, I'm almost flabbergasted. Actually, I am flabbergasted because it's not sickening. It's more like, I can't believe this happened. I'm sure there's other people out there that looked at some of their videos. Let's see what else have they uploaded here. You know, they have a pretty good destruction upload schedule. They destroy about two things a week or a few things a month. Yeah, they destroyed a giant teddy bear because, you know, it's a total mystery what they fill those things with. The one I watched almost its entirety. Oh, they destroyed a VR headset. What's inside a turtle shell? I try to give it a chance. I actually did. I watched the What's Inside a 4K Video Camera one. And the very knowledgeable. He knew all about you know, the CCDs inside the camera, you know, what type of lenses are there. Oh, no, he just said, look at the different layers of glass. Look at the microprocessor chips from cutting his camera in half. Again, you're going to say, Pat, it's his property. He can do what he wants. Yes, of course. I can destroy all these games on my wall if I want. Is it sensible? Is it reasonable? Does it make fucking sense to do it? That's the question. It doesn't. It just doesn't. When you have, I think the big takeaway from watching the Pac-Man cabinet destruction video was him, his comment, some kind of amplifier for the energy. I think that it was the biggest technological discussion point I think this man brought up during this. But, you know, good on you. Good on everyone out there giving this guy's views, you know, so he can make, you know, I don't know, he can make his hundreds of thousands of dollars off his YouTube channel to encourage him to buy more shit to destroy. So you jackals out there can enjoy that. And then the cycle continues. Not you guys jackals watching the CU podcast. But just a fucking terrible video. And, you know, and then you go from that to the guy who was the father of Pac-Man passing away a week after that. It's just more unsettling the more I thought about both things here. I just don't understand it. I don't understand it. I don't understand the person doing it. I don't understand why they think, how they think this is ethical or right. And I don't understand why people fucking watch this shit. Pretty interesting to see mainstream media cover video game collecting, let alone this video game collecting. The New Yorker, the old-timey publication, ran an article online by Simon Parkin, The Unexpectedly High-Stakes World of Neo Geo Collecting. Now, we rarely talk about Neo Geo collecting on the podcast for two reasons. One, there's really not many out there that really are actively into Neo Geo collecting. And two, I'm not into it. Ian's not into it, so we don't have a lot of knowledge of it. I do have some Neo Geo games. I do have an AES. I have a consolized MVS I want to start playing. So I do have a cabinet now I want to restore. And obviously, I love Neo Geo as a kid. I played it in the arcade. It was one of my favorite things to go to an arcade and, you know, play King of the Monsters, play Puzzle Bobble, you know, Super Spy. That even that first run of games back then, Baseball Stars, you know, back then. It's hard to talk about this stuff, though, just because you're really getting into the weeds of a very, very smaller, very small collector community who have very, very big pockets that I'm not a part of and never will be. It's just, it's a world that I'm scared to enter. I don't have the pocketbooks to enter that market to spend, you know, $3,000 for a rare game or $10,000 there and $20,000 there, and then it just starts piling up. It's just not me. So this article follows Sean McCleskey, who runs NeoGeo.com, and he used Inheritance in the 90s to buy Neo Geo games all the way back then when they were, you know, still available new, and they weren't as coveted as they are now. And so what happens, you know, 20 years later, big business, he has a collection still, he's selling these games for tens of thousands of dollars each in some cases to other collectors, you know. So he's in a good spot because of that. If you wanted to be a completionist for Neo Geo, man, we talk about NES being tough, Neo Geo's insane. Atari's insane to be close to being completionist because some of the games there's only a handful of, if at most. But a Neo Geo, forget it. What's the big one? My Zuna Encounter? What is that even going for nowadays? 30,000? The problem with Neo Geo games is there's two problems. Because by the time the console version of these arcade games came out, no one had the console anymore. So the console came out, $600+, not including the games. The games at the time were what, $150, $200 US back in the early 90s? Yes, they were the exact arcade games. That was, of course, that was the draw of the system. That was the draw of the system for me. There's no way in hell I'd ever be able to get it, but it was like, this is the Cadillac of video game consoles. So you'd stare at your service merchandise catalog, you stare at that picture. I still remember the setup. You know, Magician Lore, I think it came with. And then there was always advertising a few other games, you know, like Super Spy or Samurai Showdown. It might have been too early. Maybe Samurai Showdown, if we're talking like 93 or so. Kaizuna Encounter. And see, I'm not a Neo Geo expert. I said it wrong. It's Kaizuna Encounter. Yeah. So these are all good games, though. That's the big difference between this and collecting for Atari or NES, is that almost all the Neo Geo games are high quality. It's not like you're going to get
a Great Waldo Search Neo Geo game. You're not even going to get a, let's see. You're not even going to get something like Cyber Ball on the Neo Geo. Something that could be passable. It's just a ton of fun games. So I can see the draw there as well. But again, by the time a lot of these games came out for the console version, there was no market to sell these to, so they didn't make that many. So then you have games that already go for a lot of money. They don't make a lot. And now you have these collectors, all with deep pockets, fighting over the limited supply of some of these games where they make only 10 of per region. And that's the other thing about Neo Geo collecting that's really strange, is the, you know, people have to collect the European versus the North American version versus the Japanese version. And it's tough with these bootleggers and counterfeiters out there who go and cannibalize not only the MVS carts. They just take the chips out of them. They can throw them in to another AES cart or make their own AES cart or cannibalize the parts. Then you have high-quality reproductions of the inserts and the manuals and the cases, where it gets to the point where there are people that have been duped. This is before this article that I saw in the past years. People were duped for talking four figures and five figures on games. People losing a ton of money over counterfeit games. Which is why it's important, though, to go back to this. And I'm glad this article was written, because it's not there yet, but the NES could be there. It won't be there, though, but it could be there, because these games are so much more widely available and they sold so much more. You know, you'll never get that sort of space where, oh, the common games are going for $800, you know, for the AES. You're just not going to see that. But it's the same mentality of scumbags out there counterfeiting games, tricking people, the concerns about authenticity of rare games. It's all the same. It's just on a much smaller scale for less money. While I have to be worried about, I don't know, a counterfeit, a little Samson, I could be out $700. What about if you're out 10 grand, 15 grand, 20 grand for a game? Scale matters. Then again, you screw someone out of $15,000, that's federal fucking time right there. You're going to hard-ass prison. That's not just a fucking PayPal dispute then. You're going to be caught. Oh, trust me. Either that or someone's going to send a hitman after you. You screw someone out of 20 grand. These are game collectors that have hundreds of thousands of dollars to blow. You know, so just saying, this is a weird thing. But some of the highlights from this article before I ramble on forever about this that, again, I'm not overly familiar with. You have, for example, a service, a guy in the community that wants to remain nameless because people send him games just so he can authenticate them, because people are that wary of the market. And this is after they buy them, though. They send them to him. Recent years, counterfeit Neo Geo games have become so widespread and the fidelity so high that one collector, fidelity meaning how real these games look, it's so much easier, it's so much easier to counterfeit a $10,000 Neo Geo game than it is to counterfeit a $50 NES game. It just is. Because the cases are easier to do. They're just inserts in the plastic case. You can cannibalize the game parts easier, etc. The fidelity is so high that one collector, a graphic designer from Palm Beach County, Florida, who goes by the name 8-Man, has begun offering authentication services to other buyers. So far, he has inspected more than 50 cartridges, so he's looking at the labels, things like that, and has found many to be complete or partial fakes. In quotes, "The bootleggers have ruined it all," he told me. I guess that's what happens when a million subscribers of some retro YouTube channel run to eBay to buy that gem they just saw in a video. Okay, well, I was with you until that statement. Because guess what? There aren't enough people out there to run to eBay and are going to spend, you know, $3,000 on an AES title. Not many people are going to be running to eBay to do that, and not many retro YouTube channels are focusing or even bring up Neo Geo because of the aforementioned things I say, because the price is ridiculous and they're hard to find. That's insane. Anyone out there in the comments listening, please let me know what YouTuber with a million subscribers regularly plays Neo Geo games out there. Please let me know. Unless you're talking about someone that played it on a virtual, you know, virtual console or eShop. But then again, you're still not going to get from that. Oh my God, I'm seeing Metal Slug X being played on a Wii, I'm going to go out and buy the AES cartridge for whatever, $2,000. Is that what it's even going for? I don't know. I'm going to check right now, though. You see, it's just a kind of ridiculous statement on the surface.
Metal Slug X80.
Conversion complete, $325. That means that's not a real one. 100% authentic, $1,400, not a conversion. So that's what's interesting now, is that they've crossed over, even the bootleggers, since they know that collectors are finally on to them, they are now just putting out repros. Just repros. Which is good, though, that people aren't getting to get screwed. That's good. But you're in the same situation now where people are going to use them as placeholders. But I'm hoping that the inserts are done at least with repro on it, or, I don't know, authentic reproduction or something to differentiate. Because, come on, man, it's hard enough when people got to deal with NES repros. Now you got people out there, you know, dropping, you know, second mortgage money on a fake card. One person, a 40-year-old mathematics tutor from Thailand, says he spent at least $200,000 on Neo Geo games in the past 26 years. Wow. Wow, 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 wow. In quotes, people who grew up hearing about the Neo Geo are now grown up and earning enough to chase their childhood dream. I willing to chase it that much. I think that's the difference between these Neo Geo guys. Is that a lot of these Neo Geo guys, they're collecting. Maybe they didn't have the console as a kid. They played the arcade, but they always just wanted it. So now I want to get that Cadillac game system and collect all the games for it. Woo! Being a completionist Neo Geo collector. My God. My God. The majority of bootleggers are based in France and Germany. Now they're more upfront. Blah, 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 blah. Da-da-da. Today, most bootleggers don't bother to use original chips. Yay, that's great. They use modern off-the-shelf parts onto which game files are loaded. The experience is identical, one French bootlegger told me. And then one collector was mortified hearing about this, of course. I do hate the people making these pirate versions, he said. There you have it. So imagine if I was a Neo Geo collector. It wouldn't be the scumbag seller of the week. You'd have a hit squad out for these people that are ripping people off for tens of thousands of dollars. Little slight difference there. Now, this is a topic, believe it or not, I was thinking about this a few months ago when I downloaded every year or every other year, I try to download the updated Tecmo Super Bowl NES ROM for the new rosters they do every year, the new hack, which are excellent, by the way, since they added in the extra teams. Sometimes they added in the pictures of the players into the game besides the player stats and everything else. But how about an updated NBA Jam? You had the version that came out on the console, what, in 2010? I remember playing a Stuttering Craig on it one time. That was kind of random on my Xbox 360, probably the last time I turned on that console. But that version received, I think, mixed to pretty good reviews. I thought it was all right, a little too complicated compared to the original, but you know, I managed to beat it. It was fun for what it was. So it was worth like the $30 I spent on it or whatever it was. But I thought about why hasn't someone updated NBA Jam at all? Why not? Is it impossible? Is it too hard to change all the graphics compared to something like a Tecmo Bowl? Or people do with RBI Baseball even? Well, someone's finally done it. So the channel's called Hogs with a Blog. And this person hacked NBA Jam Tournament Edition. Which is slightly better. Now, this is the Super Nintendo version, mind you. So graphically, you're still not anywhere near where it should be. I am an NBA Jam snob, for the record. I loved this game in the arcade. Loved it. Fantastic in the arcade. However, Super Nintendo version, my friend had it, hated playing it. Hated the fact that the sound effects were simplistic. Hated the fact that almost all the players look exactly the same for their faces. At least for the original NBA Jam. I don't know if they made it a little bit better with different faces. There's only two different player heights for the console version. So that was weak. Almost no announcing. They didn't have the space in the game. There's like maybe 13 different things they say. No player names are said. It's all just, kaboom! He's on fire! Stolen! It's just not the same experience. No music during the gameplay of the original NBA Jam Super Nintendo. It's just all silent, right? That's from what I remember. Anyway, so it's cool that someone updated this. They put the digitized images in. They put new playable unlockable characters. Harambe, of course, because that meme's still really fucking funny. Hillary Clinton is in it. Well, she was in the original with Bill Clinton, I think. They both were in it. Michael Jordan's unlockable. And, yeah. You know, they updated the stats of the players. So this is it's a cool idea to do this. It is cool, and it looks like some of the player faces are a little different. Some are bald, different hair. So that's a good. So that's an improvement over the original, at least. But why not someone? Well, before I get to that, why not someone go further? It also there's two teams that weren't around back then. So what are the two ones? Memphis and Toronto are put into the rookie team. They're combined, so that's how you get to there. The jerseys and logos are not updated. This person couldn't figure out how to hack and get into that. I'm sure you could do it if you really wanted to. Someone out there could really do the Tecmo Super Bowl treatment to NBA Jam Tournament Edition on Super Nintendo. But my question is, or my statement about this is, I would rather them go one step further. Maybe it's more difficult, but if you really want to do this right, you freaking hack NBA Hang Time. Because Hang Time is so much better than Tournament Edition. The Hang Time version for Super Nintendo has all the players looking how they should, has better music, graphics, features on it, create a player mode. I think if you managed to do that, it would come out that much better. It's probably more. It's harder to do that though. Yeah, Hang Time. I remember having fun with. You play the N64 version, and it's almost exactly like the arcade. Like it's so much fun with the four players, four controllers. But the Super Nintendo one is still pretty good. It's still pretty good. And I'm looking at it right now. The gameplay. Yeah, the faces on Hang Time. Just about the 3.5 more years they had to develop that game and really get to the maximum. You know, capabilities, what the Super Nintendo could do. That's a quality game. Animations are better. Everything. Besides the fact that you have, like, you know, you have the fadeaways, you have the leaners, you time the blocks, so defense is more fun, and you have the alley-oops. So all that stuff makes it just that much better of a game, in my opinion. Not in my opinion, it just is. I mean, it's a better game. It's a better game. It's not technically an NBA Jam game, but it's in the same universe. You know, it just doesn't have the title. I think it went to Acclaim by that point. But maybe someone will get there. You know, listen to Pat and hack that for me, please. Hack NBA Hang Time on Super Nintendo. Someone just hacked the ROM. Someone hacked the freaking ROM. They did it back then. They put Michael Jordan in one version of the game that is sitting somewhere in his house somewhere, or maybe it's gone due to a gambling debt, but, you know, let's get on it. Yeah. It's time for a few sponsors. Super Audio Cart. Super Audio Cart is a virtual instrument for PC and Mac that lets musicians faithfully recreate the sounds of 8 classic video game systems, such as the NES, Game Boy, Genesis, and Commodore 64. It works with most any music-making programs like GarageBand or FL Studio, and even has received the endorsement of composers like Yasunori Mitsuda and Yuzo Koshiro. Sounds good. Hey, if these guys are doing that music originally, they think it's authentic. Sounds good to me. If you're into, you know, audio stuff at all, Ian likes to tinker. He'd probably have more words about this if he was around. But yeah, check it out. If you want to learn about the Super Audio Cart, visit superaudiocart.com and tell them Pat sent you if you can. You can't tell someone that you visited a website, I guess. Twincadia on YouTube, the YouTube channel Twincadia. Twincadia is an awesome reality show filmed in an arcade bar. When you mix booze, beer, and arcade games, hell, I did that a few weeks ago with my girlfriend at a barcade. Yeah, why not? When you mix booze, beer, and arcade games with a staff full of geeks, you get serious entertainment. Check out their YouTube show to see an exclusive behind-the-scenes look at what it means to work hard and play hard, too. You know what? I might open up a barcade in my 40s. Why not? Maybe you can learn from them how to do it. If you love retro gaming, beer, and a little bit of jackassery, who doesn't love jackasses? Search for Twincadia on YouTube. That's Twincadia, TwinCadia. Yeah, leave a comment and tell them Pat sent you from the CU podcast. Then you can leave a comment and tell them Pat sent you. You can definitely do that. It's Twincadia. Twincadia. Loot Crate. Oh, Loot Crate's back again. On a quest for epic gear, housewares, and collectibles, Loot Crate offers an epic range of pop culture items for less than $20 a month. When you're shopping for the geek in your life, or if you are that geek, you're the geek. Loot Crate is the best surprise you know is coming. Every month, there's a different theme and new exclusive items you can only get with Loot Crate. Treat yourself every month or give a geek friend. Got a geek friend? Give him that. Go to lootcrate.com/Pat. Enter code Pat and save 10% on any Loot Crate sign up. Hell, I'm wearing a shirt from the last one. I'm wearing this Mario shirt from Nintendo. That's right, baby. The original since 81. Well, he was Jumpman then, but whatever. He's Mario, damn it. The February theme. Roll up your sleeves and get ready to celebrate some of pop culture's most put-together franchises. February's theme is Build and features Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, Batman, Lego Dimensions, and Tetris. Ooh, Tetris. Wonder what could be in there for Tetris. Get it? You're building with Tetris. Batman builds and tinkers stuff. Power Rangers build their Megazord from the other ones. Yeah, that's it. And, of course, Lego. I can't see how building fits in with Lego. Anyway, you always get your monthly T-shirt and the pin. Hell, the T-shirt's worth it alone for the most part. I see people wearing the T-shirts all the time. I'm wearing it right now, like I said. You have until February 19th at 9 p.m. to subscribe and receive the build crate. After that cutoff, it's over. Again, go to lootcrate.com/Pat. Open. Oh, you open your crate, but you're going to enter code Pat to save 10% on that crate before you get it. Good news, everyone. Nintendo's figured out how to market and advertise stuff. According to reports, well, it's not just reports, it's online. There is going to be a Nintendo Switch Super Bowl commercial. That is a commercial during the big game. I like how the NFL forces everyone to say that instead of Super Bowl because they have that word trademarked and they will sue your ass if you use it even to advertise Doritos at your local supermarket. I'm not making that up. But this is a good move for them, obviously, and something I suggested a while back. I don't remember there being any mainstream Wii U commercials. I said this before, it's a broken record. I remember seeing three or four commercials in total, like the Christmas season of 2012, but after that, nothing for the Wii U. So moves like this, it's not cheap to get a Super Bowl commercial, but it's obviously worth the $20 million or so, $30 million, whatever it is, to push the product out. It absolutely is. Because, again, everyone's watching the Super Bowl, and it's not just, you know, hardcore sports fans that watch the Super Bowl. It's like the new national holiday. Kids watch it. Everyone does. Families, even if you're, you know, if you don't like the Super Bowl. My pal, 8-Bit Alley, a couple years ago, came over from Australia, and she was visiting, and, you know, I had to keep Frank away from her. But, you know, she enjoyed watching the Super Bowl. So the commercials are such a big part of it now that If you're not a sports fan or Super Bowl fan, you may scoff at, oh my God, well, that's not going to do anything. No, it's going to do something. Trust me. It's going to get a buzz about it because these are people going to be advertised to that haven't thought about Nintendo maybe in the last 15 years. Now, if they had the NES Classic Edition, oh my God, and advertised that during the Super Bowl, you'd probably sell 10 million if they had them in stock within a couple of weeks. But this is great. And the commercial is pretty good. I mean, it sort of hits on the fact that this isn't a kid's console. It has, again, that, like, 25-and-a-half-ish person, you know, happens to have their own nice place. You know, it's all clean. They're kind of hipsterish, but, you know, they're kind of average, but they're still good-looking and stuff and attractive enough to, you know. So it goes from the handheld, you know, playing Breath of the Wild, to, boom, into the dock, and then the screen lights up. I think that image alone is important because I think that's very key to the marketing of this device, where people are saying, well, they should focus on it being a handheld or focus on it being a regular home console. Well, just focus on both. You can do it in an easy way, and that's the best way to do it. Hey, throw it in the dock, boom, it's on the TV instantly. You know, I mean, what else do you want at that point? Well, you got to have the TV on, I guess, right? Unless there's some way to auto-sync the NES dock into that. The specs, by the way, of the NES Classic Edition. The specs of the NES Classic Edition, there's like only 14 out there. The specs for the Nintendo Switch have been somewhat released. And it's interesting that Eurogamer came out with the specs, and I'll just go over it briefly just because this isn't that much of a meaty topic, just talking about the Super Bowl commercial that much, even though I think it's a smart commercial, and yes, they're advertising Breath of the Wild as well as Nintendo Switch. But according to the Eurogamer stuff, you basically have the same clock speed when it's in handheld mode, CPU clock speed versus handheld mode and in the dock, but the GPU speed, doubles or I think it's like doubles or triples when it's in the dock, which makes sense because you want to limit the battery, you know, the battery usage when it's on the go. And if you had it to full graphics potential, it would drain that sucker like in an hour. So you can't have that. So it's interesting, though, that in this gambit that Nintendo's doing where they are sort of forcing their own sales and their publishers to make sure that the games are running at the lower 720p resolution, but also
at less graphics and at less intensity in terms of the graphics to make sure it has to run both on the handheld mode and then when it's docked for the TV. So it's almost like they have to develop not two different games, but it's almost we're getting into that sort of same territory with the Xbox One and the Scorpio, you know, and the PS4 and the, you know, the Neo and all that stuff. Wait, it's PlayStation, the Scorpio. I don't even know anymore. Xbox One S. So anyway, the whole point is that they're sort of tag teaming onto that, where these publishers might have to, you know, be very careful, and this might keep some publishers away because maybe and from early guesstimates, the Switch, at least when it's docked, is almost as powerful as like an Xbox One, or it's in that range. People are saying, of course, until you actually see it and see what the games are on it, you can't tell. But people are confident saying that, yeah, it's in that ballpark of an Xbox One, but it definitely ain't when it's out of the dock and when you're just playing it on the handheld itself. So that creates a problem then. It's almost getting back to that, you know, sort of, well, we have to come up with a whole new version of this, like they did with third party games on the Wii. But let's hope that, like, they can finagle it. Let's hope that you can get some games that are good enough to still be on the Xbox One, because they're going to be making games for the Xbox One for a few years, not just, you know, the upgraded versions. Let's hope that they can sort of get that onto the Nintendo Switch, at least in the docked mode, and then the handheld mode will look like an Atari 7800 game. That's what I'm guessing. But anyway, Super Bowl commercials, cool. I'm really curious to seeing the reaction from people who haven't uttered the name or word Nintendo since the 90s and see what they think about it, about the commercial. But I think it's gonna do pretty well. I think it's straightforward. It shows The Legend of Zelda, and it shows that hipster 25-year-old in the future Nintendo dystopia where they kill everyone at their 30th birthday. We have an update. Oh, we have an update for the NES Classic Edition. Woo! So they hacked it more so to a new version where you are now allowed no more game limits, because they figure out how to upload them in batches. I think it's batches of 60 games. So you can just do a batch upload and get them on there instead of only just doing the one batch of adding the 60. So this is good news. This is getting to the point where I'm actually start to look into this more. I'm like, okay, if I have a free few hours, or people say, Pat, it takes a half hour, whatever. The whole point is that if I have a rainy day Sunday afternoon, rainy day, that's too specific. If I have time to do this at some point, I think I'll at least do this and try it. And I have one as well, just in case I break the first one. But this first one's probably going to go to someone that wants it and add the games that they want. But it supports folders and pages now for the hack. And this is the Hacksheet 2.11. So you can have folders and pages, which I think is good, because I think one of the things that people weren't taking into account with the original, with 90 games, you can scroll through that fairly quickly. How are you going to scroll through the NES Classic Edition at that speed with 600 plus games? That's going to take you a few minutes to get to a game. That's not going to be a quick one. There's no like fast scrolling feature on the NES Classic Edition. I mean, there's no skip 50 games or skip 100 games. Let's say put that in, that'd be cool. So it's good that you can have folders, I guess, for the letter. That'd be great. It'll automatically create and sort games alphabetically. Great. Great. There's 655 games that they verified according to this update with no errors. We're getting there. We're getting there, folks. They're working their way. They're drilling inside of this bad boy to doing that. But that's still 600 is respectable. But hey, I want to play Action 52 too, you know. But now they're getting to the space limit. 512 meg of free space that you can use on the NES Mini. Da, 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 da. And you can probably get, this is from the commentary, you can probably get over 800 ROMs into it before damaging it. Always make sure to back up the original kernel before making any changes. So, okay, here's a list of the updates to this version. Yep, you have the folders page support, no more games limit. Automatically create folders and sort games alphabetically, tested with over 600 ROMs. Everything working, including save states. You can select maximum games per page folder, but it's recommended to limit it to 30-35. Uh-oh. So you can't just do like a folder with all the S games. Multi-step uploading. Hacksheet 2 will split up the uploads and upload in sequence in the kernel. Mass cover downloading. That's pretty cool. You can download covers for all games at once using First Image on Google.
What if that first image isn't accurate or isn't a cover? IPS patcher can enlarge ROMs now. That's for the largest ROMs out there, probably. Like the Koei games, for example, are usually the larger ROMs. New patches for problem games, new confirm mapper. So they're starting to get there. We'll see. Support for some bad ROMs. Full Famicom Mini support. Japanese font customizable original games list. Oh, so you can actually get the Famicom Mini stuff off of that, not to the NES Classic Edition. That's because it's the same guts. That's pretty cool. Auto Fire. That's really sweet. Auto Fire. Hold select plus A and B for a second to enable Auto Fire. Da-da-da. Also, XY buttons on the Classic Controller will now act as Auto Fire AB. Shit, what if I want to use those XY just as regular AB, though? I guess it's during the menu, you can disable that. The start button simulation for the second controller. Hold up plus A plus B to press start. It's a workaround for some USA games on Famicom Mini. Oh, I see. If you want to play a Nintendo World Championships, that's the way to do it with only one controller. Disable menu music. Why do you want to disable the menu music? It's bubbly. And then other stuff. Oh, where's the home button? Is that? I thought they were going to put the home button in. Am I missing that with this one? I heard that they cracked that. They got the home button command now. Oh, man. Oh, well, they'll get there, I guess. All right, so I'm there. I'm on board. I don't need my RetroPie or my PSP. Forgot that last time. PSP, you can get all the ROMs in there. Or my little Chinese knockoff phone that acts like a smartphone or a PSP device. My friend John has one of those. I recommend one. Those are pretty cheap. They basically act like little devices you can load on emulators and stuff, and they have buttons.
They have buttons and sounds and screens.
All right. Yeah, Classic Edition, hack this. Someone has done God's work and has cataloged a complete Nintendo Wii set of games. User Nintendo Tweezer? Nintendo Tweezer on Nintendo Age posted his every game made for the Wii, which is 1,262. So that doesn't include the variants, the demos, the two packs, and the Netflix disc. The Netflix disc, you needed to run Netflix. I think I have that somewhere. They found it at the swap meet. Da-da-da-da. One game was released in 2016, Just Dance 2017. They're pretty confident that's it. I mean, I can't picture at this point. It pretty good run. There was games regularly on the Wii for like 7 years about. So I think that's a good run. Very good run. So let's go on to my favorite website. I love you guys. You guys are just a kick in the balls. I mean, that's what you threatened me on the website for, but, you know. So, let's go. Let's run through this. And again, thanks to Nintendo Tweezer for doing this. Someone had to do it. Mike Edler did it for the NES back in the late 90s, and while it wasn't totally accurate, you have to start somewhere. Someone's got to get down to the nitty-gritty and go at it. So, North American set of game. Games, 1,262. Shared a spreadsheet because he's a nice guy. What does or doesn't count? We went over it before. What doesn't count? He has a little FAQ. Is it a good time to collect for the Wii? Hell yeah! He says, as any long-time collector will tell you, the cheapest time to collect for a system is when it's at its low point. And yes, the prior generation, if not two generations, this is the low point. So in terms of collecting for the Wii, he's absolutely right. You're at a time now when, you know, a lot of these games are dirt cheap. There's a lot of ones out there that no one either knows about or cares about. It's weird that a system that has over 1,200 games isn't really, like, you can't start just rattling off, you know, even 100 Wii games that people care about, you know, or 50 games. It's almost like it's the GameCube where you have, like, your few dozen games people care about, and then, but unlike the GameCube smaller library, and then you have a bunch of fucking shovelware that's like 950 fucking games, you know, after that. So that's where you're at, though. So if you want to get into collecting, you know, go for it. If you honestly want to collect it, in terms of the value going up, I'll get into that in a bit. So, This collector said, bought a ton of games for under $5, many in the $1 to $4 range. Didn't pay over $25 for a single game. So there you go. He bought him a lot of GameStop, buy two, get one free. This person's fascinated by the Wii because it sold over 100 million. Yeah, it's a very successful Nintendo. It's the most successful Nintendo console. Let's go over some of the lists here. There's a video put together of the top 40 rarest Wii games. This is where I understand why you would do this, but I question the timing of picking just the 40 rarest, because I think you're going to unfortunately influence people's buying patterns a little bit, because, hell, there's not a lot of fucking Wii collectors out there. You might get some people just drop on and saying, oh, I want to collect the 40 rarest Wii games because this guy said that it's rare and I want the value to go up on it. So you might get some weird artificial inflation from this. I'm going to take one of the games right now and look at the cost of it. So, you know, it's tough to put a list together like this because you're at a stage now where there's still stores selling these games brand new. I'm not talking about necessarily like a GameStop. I'm sure if you go out to some electronic stores, they have new old stock in the back. It's still on display, some of these games. It's in clearance bins at some stores. Some supermarkets probably have Wii games there still. You know, these games are not all accounted for by a fucking long shot, especially given the fact that such a weird percentage is like shovelware and sort of cashing games. You know, we're talking Atari 2600 stuff here where, oh, you got to, you know, you figure out how to work a game where you move your hand around. All right, this is the 10th bowling game for the system now. You know what I mean? Like, this is a system that's like a mile wide and an inch deep. That's really what the Wii is. There's one game on this list. This is the top 40 rares. Let's see. Let's Sing 2016. There's someone on eBay right now that's selling new old stock of it or just new stock. So it's readily available, and who knows how many copies. Let's see. Let's Sing 2016 Wii. It's $22 sealed. $22 sealed, but more than 10 available, 19 sold. And I was tracking this game for a few months because this was the hottest game that's now going to be like the Steam events I saw post. And it's like a ton of fucking copies showed up because this, let's see, Closeout Goods. It's a wholesaler that gets stock that no one wants, and they're sitting on a bunch of these games. So if they are, who knows? So it's tough to start labeling these games. Again, I'm not trying to put this person down. I think where it's a little bit too soon. You can say, I'd be more comfortable with someone saying, these are probably going to be the rare games over time, versus these are probably going to be the more common ones, versus saying, these are definitely the 40 hard-to-find games. I think it's a little premature for that right now. We're not 20 years out from the system being released, and we're only technically really about 4 years of it being dead. And in terms of games being produced, we're less than a year of games being past of games being produced. So I'm cautioning everyone when you're collecting for a newer system. If you're going to collect, don't collect just for the rarity, because I think you can't really tell straight up that soon. I think you got to go at least two or three generations way behind before you can say, okay, my fucking five and dime store. Is there any five and dimes anymore? My local store down the street has this Wii game that's supposed to be rare, and they have 50 at the dollar store down the street. They have, you know, 50 of this shovelware game, and that, I mean, I can't imagine trying to gauge the rarity of these games based upon the fact that there's so much shovelware. I remember going to my flea market back in New Jersey still in 2000, and when I still lived there in 2008, there was tons of new shovelware even at the flea markets. It somehow got there, even from the stores to the flea markets, selling Wii games just in these boxes. Like, it was just garbage, you know? So let's see. Let's just see what else he has to say here. But that's what I'm going to caution about just that, though, right now. Yeah, this is very rare list of games, uncommon games, common but desirable. Then the complete Wii set, which it looks impressive, and he has all the multicolored Wii emotes, which is pretty cute to me. So if you're going to collect for a system, he does it for the proper reason. He's doing because he loves the Wii. He has an interesting story behind it. Don't collect the Wii if you think it's going to be worth, you know, $1 million, 20 years from now, or it's going to be like the NES or even Super Nintendo or even N64, which is rising a little bit, but, you know, I don't think that's going to go up forever. Just because, again, shovelware, tons of games, a lot of these games are not desirable. We look at some of these very rare games, okay? At the very least on the NES, a lot of the very rare games are fun. A lot of those title, late releases, you know, Little Samson, you get like Bonk's Adventure, you get Panic Restaurant. You know, you have some solid ones there that, okay, if I want to dish out a lot of money, these are at least fun games. And even with the very uncommon games, you can find that. Because a lot of the later releases, once you get to like 92, 93, they only put out some games that, these are games that, you know, more limited. Like Mega Man 6 is a little bit more limited than the rest, you know. But in this list, you have stuff like National Geographic Challenge, Chuck E. Cheese Sports Games, Cyberbike Cycling Sports, American Mensa Academy. There's about 15 different racing games on here from the top four. Burger Bot. Okay. So Fritz Chess, Aqua Panic, Get Fit with Mel B. Oh, Mel B from the Spice Girls. All right, I'm on board with that. So what you're gonna see though then is maybe those 20 or 30 completionist collections, even if, you know, if there's going to be 30 Wii completionist collectors out there, I'll be shocked, at least this year. Give it 30 years, and maybe you're going to have all those kids that finally remember playing Wii Sports going out in their 30s when we're in our 70s, and then buying it. You know what I mean? Like, and buying all these. But even then, I don't see that happening, because these weren't games that were ubiquitous at all. There's no way you could have known all these games were being released. You know, it's not like Nintendo Power was going to be advertising, you know, My Horse and Me Riding for Gold. Maybe they did. But you see my point, though. There's too many games coming out from them to really track all this garbage that's on the system. Then there's common but desirable games. I think that's where this is going to end up. I think the Wii is going to end up where you're going to have everyone rush to get those 100 or so games that people actually care about that want to play. And that's like Kirby Dream Collection, Godzilla Unleashed, Fire Emblem Radiant Dawn. You know, so Samurai Showdown Anthology. Ooh, that's a cool idea. I think I want to get that. So, see, then even I'm intrigued by some of these, where it's like, oh, okay, obviously games like Xenoblade Chronicles. You know, you have your Metroid Prime collection on there. You know, that trilogy collection. You know, stuff like that, I think, is what people are going to want to come back to for this system. So, let's everyone give a big hand to this individual. His name's Aaron, actually. Aaron, good job, buddy. You did God's work to get us to a good, more than good starting place, and we'll see. We'll see how many people get on board with the Wii going forward. It'll be interesting to see how this evolves, how this gets tweaked, if there's any more games that might be found or not, but probably not. You know, it's easier to track through, you know, nowadays how many games came out, and I don't think there were licensed Wii games, you know. So it'll be interesting though to see, like I said before, what games will drop from being, you know, uncommon or rare just to being common when they find, you know, a box of 1,000 of one game in the 40 rarest games, which is totally possible. You know, finding a pallet of these games or just boxes scattered all around the U.S., like my pal Tim Atwood. Here we go, folks. There was a video put out by former associate of Pat Contries, Matt Pat, called Deadlock, which I guess is a series he has. And I guess it's like it's some sort of debate show. There's high production quality. There's CG and stuff and little pixel art. It's cute. It's cute. And this one was interesting because this was not the first but second time that Reggie Fils-Aimé was on there. And this was to talk about Nintendo. And should Nintendo abandon consoles is the name of the video. So it's one and the other. You don't know if they're in the same room. I think they were in the same room in front of a green screen, actually, because you can see the hand of one person, the other shot. Should Nintendo abandon consoles? And it's a silly premise, so I'm not going to get on my pal Matt Pat
I'm not going to get on MatPat for doing the video because, hey, it's a job. I doubt he wrote all the script. He wrote part of it. It was presented to him, and he hosted the fucking thing. You know, and Nintendo saw it as a way to advertise the Switch because there was a chunk section in the middle where they're basically, it's just, it becomes an advertiser for the Switch. I mean, it's just blatant. I'm not sure if he was paid or not, but, you know, it's a blatant advertiser for the Switch, which is fine. Nintendo has to get the Switch out there. I want the Switch to be successful. You should want it to be successful too. It's fine. It's absolutely fine. But there's some questionable logic going on in this video. And it's not based 100% on my argument in the past about why the Switch will be more successful for definitely in the Wii U, but we'll get into some points here. So some points from the video I jotted down while I was watching it. So one of the arguments that's brought up by MatPat in the video is that how the stock prices are spoken of. And he talks about the stock price spiking of Nintendo in 2015 when they announced they're entering the mobile market. But what wasn't spoken of in the video was the roller coaster ride of the stock price, how it shot up and back down when the whole Pokemon Go stuff was going on last summer, and how the stockholders didn't realize Nintendo wasn't totally responsible for Pokemon Go. They only had a minor stake in it, and so they should temper their expectations on the profits at least a little bit. So that argument means to me is that the stock value should not be the main point of contention. It should be, what is the company's value? And yes, stock prices play into overall company value, but it's not the entire picture. It is a picture, part of the picture, though. And I think that's what should be the focus overall. If you're going to talk about stocks, you got to talk about what's the value of your company now. You know, that's really the most important part of that puzzle to me. Stock prices can flutter and go up and go, and they can be, and stock prices can be way overvalued anyway. So that's not a proper way to even argue, even fakely in a script to, you know, the president of a company. That just was weird to me. Well, the whole video was weird, which we'll get into, but anyway. All right, so Super Mario Run is brought up and how the conversion rate wasn't the best. It underperformed. I'm not sure what standards they were speaking to in that video that MatPat was reading off the script. What numbers were they totally expecting for a $10 app, which is a little pricey. But what we found out and has been released is that there was 80 million downloads, okay? And 5% of the 80 million paid for it, okay? Ended up unlocking it. So let's do some Pat math here. Let's do some Pat math here. 80, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Pat math's my favorite time. Not MatPat, Pat math. All right. So that means 4 million people. And again, this is not on any Android devices yet, which there's a lot more Android devices nowadays than iOS. 4 million times 10. That's a $40 million revenue stream right there in only 2.5 months. That ain't bad for a game that they didn't put a lot of money or R&D into. You know, that's not bad at all. I would take that. I would definitely take that. That's better than nothing. They did not. There's not a loss on the on this app. There absolutely is not a loss. They're not operating at a loss here. Again, I don't know what Apple's cut is here, but special. But even if their cut's only 70% the standard, $28 million. Nintendo has made a minimum $28 million. Of gross revenue so far, not including the Android ones, which will probably make the same amount, if not more, on overall. So it's fine. And Nintendo announced they're going to do 2 to 3 new apps or games a year. So I think they're going to tap into that market just fine. That's okay. A good point that Reggie brought up, thank God I was going to fucking tear my hair out, was that, and one that I should have probably emphasized more in the past videos, is that Nintendo's really the only one doing hardware innovation anymore. They're the only ones trying to do new stuff with a gaming console, or at least taking the risks. Microsoft and Sony are basically sitting behind being, okay, what's Nintendo doing? Motion controls? Is that going to work? Okay, we'll try to dip our toes in here. Okay, all right, we're going to do that. Microsoft and Sony's innovation with the PS4
an Xbox One is, okay, these are powerful gaming rigs now. They're supercomputers. That's their innovation. There is no innovation. They're taking parts from that you can get in a PC and throwing it into a console. That's their innovation. As much as you guys want Nintendo to not put out hardware anymore, what would you want the landscape to be then? You know, like, would you just want to have either a PC or games? I could also play on a PC. What's the point of having gaming consoles then? If that's the point, you might as well say, hey, Sony, Microsoft, you guys should go third party then, which Microsoft already has for the most part, because now a lot of their Xbox One games you'll be able to get on the PC as well, at least on Windows 10. So that's already done. But Nintendo ain't doing that. They ain't doing that. Too much profits to be had, potentially. They ain't going to give it up. I'm not going to stop. And hell, they just even announced more NES Classic Editions. That counts as hardware, too, if you remember. MatPat says at 6 minutes in, Super Mario Run is proof that Nintendo can still bring new ideas to the table. Super Mario Run was not a new idea. It was repackaging elements from New Super Mario Bros. U and then just shoving it somewhat eloquently, I will say, into a runner style, endless runner style game. So it's not a new idea. It's just that they're doing an app, and you just said before that they underperformed. So what are you really saying then? They underperformed on a new idea. They are bringing new ideas to the table. The fact that their new console is really a portable, but then hooks to the TV, the opposite of the Wii U, is really a fresh new idea. Says just for create the peripherals. All right. I think you're going to get into a weird... If you saw Nintendo start creating peripherals just for their certain games, I think that would be an awful idea. Because you'd have them dumped within a few months, like you see all the freaking Rock Band and Guitar Hero equipment. Players don't want to have to shell out money that only worked for very specific games. We are way past that. We are past that there ever being that anymore and having an appeal besides it being a fad like music games, which had a small comeback, but still that's not coming back. We're past that point. Even the Zapper on the NES, there was only a dozen Zapper games, you know? Well, let's look at a certain NES guide app, and I'll tell you for sure. But there wasn't... Thank God I have it. I can not know, you know, not talk entirely out of my ass about this stuff. But we are past that point where there's going to be sort of marquee accessories just for a couple of games. I don't see that happening ever again. I think that if you do that, that would be an awful idea. That would hurt your sales, because then instead of selling your game for only $60, if Nintendo went third party, now we got to go third party $60, plus you got to buy our $40 controller or our $80 controller. Who's going to do that for 3 to 5 games they really want versus buying a system where every game has to then be used with that controller set? It just doesn't make any logical or any business sense to do that. It just doesn't. You think, well, they're going to make money anyway. They're not. The money's not going to come there. I mean, basically, when you're buying a Nintendo Switch, you're forced to buy the Nintendo controllers, so they're making a profit on that, but that's going to be used for every game on the system. I think that's a really backwards way of doing business, where you're going to say, oh, just create the peripherals, and without really thinking about what's the actual market then. You know, that's just a weak idea, weak argument. Going back to this, I talked to someone on Twitter about this, about how many games Nintendo would have to make up in sales to cover the losses of not getting profits from hardware. Does anyone actually want to try and calculate that out? For real. I'm not trying to be snarky here. It's going to be a lot of fucking games, though. A lot. In my head, with my pat math, they would have to try to sell 5 times as many first-party games to make up for that loss in console revenue. 5 times. And you're not even counting at that point the loss of profit, and this is a lot bigger profit, for those extra controllers and accessories. And I know this means just like, you know, those special controllers you want to sell on your own, but I'm talking about that extra power cord, that extra, you know, little controller case, you know, protector, extra sensor bar, you know, stuff like that. That little stuff that people need sometimes, that money adds up quickly. You know, memory cards on past consoles, another good one, where it's like profits up the ass on that. You imagine how much profit Sony made from like PS2 memory cards. They're worthless, and they were selling at like 10-15 bucks a pop.
or whatever. Even if you think that the profit margin is smaller than games for console sales, which it is, the games make a lot more money than consoles overall. Peripherals and accessories make up for a ton of profit still. So you can't do that. The amount, and plus, Nintendo doesn't have that foothold. Nintendo's not in the position they are to have franchises. They're not like, you could say, okay, Mario's the most popular sort of guy out there. But if you look at the sales, the most popular like game on the Wii, not even the Wii U, on the Wii did 40 million. On the Wii. And that was one game. That was the Mario Kart Wii game. That was a big system seller. Or the most popular game on that system, you know, Mario Kart Wii, without looking at the list, it probably is. But there's not many more of those. I think like Smash Brothers did like 10 or 11 on the Wii and on the Wii U, like not even that much, like half of that on the Wii U. So the proportions don't work out. There's no Call of Duty franchise. There's no Battlefront. There's no Madden that Nintendo's going to put out that everyone's going to run and buy anyway. So just saying go third party, without actually thinking about how many more games they'll push is really, really just thoughtless. Just thoughtless. By the way, saying goodbye to hardware means saying goodbye to Amiibo. I know that you could try to sell Amiibo without the controller functionality, but I don't see that working quite as well, even though people do collect these as toys. But Amiibo, again, we always forget about the Amiibo. How much money has Nintendo made off those fucking pieces of plastic? A ton. We go back to the argument about third-party support. And then Nintendo, you know, Nintendo not having third-party support is going to mean it's going to fail. Nintendo didn't have good third-party support on the N64 or the GameCube. And those did just fine. They turned a profit. Obviously, they weren't as big a success as they should have been compared to the competitors. Sure. Handhelds were totally ignored in the video. I'm surprised Reggie didn't bring it up and say, hey, we got the 3DS. We got this 3DS thing that's made us a ton of money. 61 million of these bad boys sold. That wasn't brought up. And his other comment, he says, people don't want to shell out a few hundred dollars just to play a few select titles. That's Reggie should have said in the video, what do you think the Xbox One and PS4 are? What do you think those are? Since a chunk of those you can play either on the other console or you can get it on the computer. And everyone owns a computer. So it's silly. It's just a silly argument. If people really want to play Breath of the Wild and buy two other games for the Switch, they're going to do that. You know, it's sort of a once-in-a-lifetime experience. There's not a Zelda game out every year. It's like, what, every 5 years, a major console Zelda game, something like that. So it's not like you're going to have to repeat it anytime soon for that. Another quote I got from here, almost every manufacturer loses money on console sales. Why not remove that risk entirely? Because the reward is huge for consoles. That's why, because Nintendo has made bank on all their consoles except for the Wii U. That's why you don't remove the risk. You remove the risk if you don't want to make money. You remove the risk. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Well, Nintendo ventured out with that Wii system and made billions of dollars from it. So, I mean, it's just a silly argument to bring up. Silly argument. The revenue from the Wii was roughly $20 billion. That doesn't count peripherals. Doesn't count extra fucking Wiimotes that everyone went out and bought either. So, yeah, so if you're talking 100 million Wii consoles that sold, you also realize that means that at least you sold at least 100 million Wiimotes, most likely, because everyone went out and bought a second one, or more than one, or just saving half. They probably sold 50 million Wiimotes, and then 50 million nunchucks. Think about that for a second. Think about what that means, the revenue from that. That's insane. That is insane for that. Those little shitty nunchucks that cost, what, $15 each? That cost Nintendo $1.50 to make each, you know what I mean? And I'm tired of people saying the Wii's an outlier. Like, the Wii's this giant outlier in Nintendo's history. The Wii's an outlier! Never mind the fact that the NES dominated the market. You know, when the NES was out, 90% of the market share was the NES. For the first few years, you know? Super Nintendo did gangbusters. You know, Wii's this outlier. Game Boy dominated the handheld market. Game Boy Advance, the DS, 3DS dominates the market. Yeah, the Wii's just this little outlier. Go away. Go away, Wii. Hardware is hardware. The strategy is the same. overall. You want to sell the games and the hardware, you got to make the hardware and sell it. And you get the revenue from both. Just silly. Just silly. And 64 was a success too. Yeah, it was dwarfed by the PS1. It was still a success. Nintendo earned a profit from that. With all the controllers they sold, all the fucking memory cards and the little rumble packs besides their first party games. It's just silly. It's just silly. By the way, the Power Glove was brought up at some point for some reason. And like it was pointed out as like, for shame, Nintendo tried the Power Glove out. Nintendo didn't make the Power Glove. I'm not sure if the editor or writer of that video realized that. Mattel did the Power Glove. Where's my one out in the box up there? There it is. Mattel did it. So that's just a sort of a waste. It was a sort of a little waste. It was a cute little joke, but it was a waste. That's all. And then finally, the one thing that really annoyed me was that the comparison to Sega. And that's where Reggie should have just had a veto power on the script and be like, dude, don't fucking put Nintendo and Sega into the same paragraph, let alone the same sentence. False equivalency. It was awful about how MatPat's argument was, well, the year after Sega left the console market, they turned a profit for the first time forever. Nintendo is not in Sega's position. The dire, dire straits that Sega... Sega had to leave the console market. They were bleeding money. They were in really bad shape. Nintendo is not in really bad shape. Nintendo is in good shape. Very good shape. You cannot start saying, well, go third party like Sega did. You can't do that because Sega doesn't have the properties that Nintendo has either. Sonic isn't Mario. Sonic's popular. Mario is 10 times as popular. Legend of Zelda, what do you compare to that? Phantasy Star? Not in the same fucking universe of popularity. Smash Brothers, Virtua Fighter? Fighting Vipers or something? Was that Sega, right? Like, no. No. Mario Kart, what's your comparison? Daytona USA? Is there a Sonic kart racer I should know about? Crazy Taxi, yeah, that's as popular as Metroid, isn't it? You see how silly it gets when you start just throwing out statements like, oh, they should just go third party. Because of that, they have a draw to get people to their first party games, unlike Sega did at the end. If Sega's games were a draw, the Dreamcast would have been a much bigger success and Sega would still be around. But it didn't work out. Besides other mismanagement, though, it didn't work out. Not everyone needs to play, you know, the next Crazy Taxi or the next Sonic game. Everyone needs to play that Breath of the Wild or that new Mario Kart game. Those are system sellers. The new Super Mario Odyssey game, that's a system seller. Sonic Adventure, not everyone needs to play that game. I'm sorry. That's just the way it is. The smartphone revolution, which I laugh at, that was brought up in the video, and that if it hasn't taken over gaming by now, it's never going to happen. Sorry. You can never totally emulate the experience of playing a game on a PC or on a console on a fucking phone. It's just, I fucking hate that. The most popular mobile games are totally different experiences than the most popular console and PC games. There's no popular fucking first-person multiplayer shooter I'm playing on my mobile phone. I'm not playing a Mass Effect game, a third-person, huge adventure game. That's not going on your phone ever. Sorry. That's not happening. Just not. Your phone will blow up like the freaking Galaxy Note 7 or whatever because of the drain from the too much processing power. It's just silly. There are two entirely different markets and two entirely different sets of games for the most part on that. So anyway, I hope I can get Reggie on a video sometime. But I'm glad that Reggie defended himself. I'm hoping that he wrote a lot of that himself or with help from Nintendo, because a lot of those arguments in that video were just absolutely silly. They're just silly. How about a strange Kickstarter? It's a Kickstarter for an Apocalypse Now game? Like an adventure RPG? From the key team members, not the producer, like main producer, key team members from Fallout, New Vegas, Wasteland 2, Far Cry, and a lot of RPGs. A Kickstarter. Apocalypse Now, what was that, 74, 75? Francis Ford Coppola directed it. Apocalypse Now. I don't think he's directed much in the past 20 years.
based upon Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, which I read in high school. That took place in sub-Saharan Africa. They moved it to the Vietnam War for this. Oh, 1979. I thought it was earlier for some reason. That was like 75. 1979, Trell production. Production took like forever. Multiple cuts of this movie. They filmed a ton of this. I still have not seen it all. I will at some point. Frankel's gonna punch me if he hears that. In a certain NES guidebook, I spoke about how it was strange to do a Platoon NES game. It was also on the computer. Same vein as Apocalypse Now. At least that Apocalypse Now is going to be in the PC and not a kiddie console like the NES, you know, for the most part. But this Kickstarter is asking for $900,000. So there's a video that was put up, minute long. It shows it. There's some shots of things you see in the movie. You have little river boating action. You have the helicopters coming in here. It looks interesting. I don't know if there's a market for this game though. I just don't. Well, we shall see. In the description of the game, let's see. It's a heavy emphasis on an RPG-like narrative with branching outcomes. You will explore the jungles and rivers of Vietnam in first-person perspective. You join a crew of, in quotes, rock and rollers with one foot in their grave. It's like Fallout New Vegas on acid in the middle of the Vietnam War. Ultimate mission is to assassinate Colonel Kurtz, a rogue American officer who's accused of forming a private army and operating totally beyond the pale of any acceptable human conduct, which was a chunk of the Vietnam War, unfortunately. Combat is often your last resort. You play as Captain Willard, who was Martin Sheen in the movie. Either skills you can upgrade, they'll impact how you interact with characters you meet and how you navigate the jungle. Yeah, I'm just not... I guess I have to see more about this, but this is going to be a really delicate game to pull off. To sort of move, you know, sort of a psychedelic nightmare of a Vietnam War film. You know what I mean? Like, this is going to be a weird... but hey, we'll see what happens with it. We'll see what happens. I wonder if Ian has seen Apocalypse Now. I gotta sit down with Frank at least and watch this thing. It's time for the Scumbag Seller of the Week. This Scumbag Seller of the Week happens to be someone that I found by myself by accident. Jay Cena 012483, or I guess for John Cena for short. And what were they selling? Why, a certain NES guidebook. They were selling Ultimate Nintendo Guide to the NES Library. What? All right, so obviously you can sell whatever you want if you own it. You have a game, you can sell it used. You have a certain NES guidebook, you can sell it. That's not what the issue is here. The issue is they lied in the description. They lied. This auction is for the Ultimate Nintendo Guide to the NES Library book by Pat Contry. This book has been sold out ever since the release of the NES Classic Edition console. Well, I wish I could take credit for that, but no, it was actually sold out after Thanksgiving. There is a pre-order for a second printing, but you'll have to wait months to get it. Ding, ding, ding. That's what's false. Because you know why? The book is back in stock! Pre-order it. Actually, not pre-order. Order it at ultimatenes.com. It's back in stock, folks. So, now is your chance to get the original book before everyone else gets the reprint months from now. First of all, it's not a reprint, it's a second print. You know, it's not like it's unauthorized. I have the book in hand and ready to ship. The book is in great shape with some minor wear around the edges. Aha! You got wear around the edges from mail transit. Well, but for all the beautiful full-color pages aside, and the binding is mint. All right. So, I understand you want to make your money back. You didn't enjoy a certain NES guidebook. You want to sell it and at least get back the $60 you paid. And then for $102. But you basically screwed someone out of $40 because the book's back in stock. You lied about it. And I emailed you, sir. I emailed you before the auction ended saying, hey, listen, do whatever you want, but you're not giving the right information here. Someone's getting duped here. The book's going to be shipping out any day now. The pre-orders and the orders are start shipping again. So come on, man. Come on. Don't do this to me with my product. Come on, you're making it personal now. This is a personal Scumbag Seller of the Week here. All of my items come free. All of my items come free, a smoke-free, child-free, pet-free home. Would your children get into, like, I understand smoke-free. Pet-free, they're going to shit on your books? Your children are going to piss on it?
That's kind of a weird thing to say about that. I offer a 30-day return policy. Oh, please. Whoever won this book, please. I tell you what. Whoever wins this book, if you return this book and get your money back, I will mail you out there a free copy of the book. I will mail it to you, whoever won this item. Please. Please. You must know me. Hopefully you know me if you bought this. If you return this book to Aurora, Illinois, to JCena, 012-483, return it, get your money back, get your $100 back, I will mail you a free copy of the book. It'll be mailed to you. I will do that. I obviously have to have evidence that you purchased this auction, but if you provide me the evidence, show me the PayPal transaction to that seller, I'll mail it to you. That's how much this bothers me. This really bothers me. Because not only because the information was false and misleading, wait months to get it. Eat my ass. It's not a month. It's not months. It's going out now. But the fact that I contacted them, they ignored me because they thought the extra $40, most likely that they got out of this from this false advertising, is worth annoying me. It's not. Their other items for sale are just wrestling items, like fucking wrestling figures. I'm not saying I'm a wrestling fan. Not all wrestling fans are assholes, but a lot of assholes are wrestling fans. Oh, yes, I see that in my Twitter feed, and I see that. I see a good amount of that, even going to the shows. That's coming from a wrestling fan. Who keeps texting me? Don't text me during the Scumbag Sell of the Week. Jesus. Let's talk about the Royal Rumble, huh? So the Royal Rumble event, it's one of the only two events I watch every year. I mean, that I have to watch for the WWE. But it's fun because you usually have surprises. You know, there's some fanfare with the actual Royal Rumble event itself. It's a chance to see an old-timer come back or a surprise entrant like AJ Styles last year in 2016 was awesome, awesome debut, and he got a huge pop, which was great. My pal Kenny Omega is signed back with New Japan Pro Wrestling for another year. So he was not at the Rumble. Maybe next year. But, you know, he put on a... By the way, Kenny Omega put on at least a five-star match at Wrestle Kingdom 11. Check it out. Just off the charts, 45 minutes, and just one of the best matches you'll ever see. Match of the year, early match of the year. But there are some good matches, though, at Royal Rumble. Not a match of the year, but a very good match between John Cena and AJ Styles for the title. I don't mind AJ Styles losing because he lost like a champ. Like, it took an avalanche, AA, and Cena rolling through and hitting two more basically in a row. After AJ kicked out of the Avalanche AA in order to beat him. Like, he really had to have the kitchen sink come out to beat AJ Styles. So AJ Styles is hugely popular, even though he's a heel, because it's because people respect the hell out of him, and he's the champ that runs the camp. He's the face that runs the place, which I think is endearing. I think they'll turn him face at some point this year. I think it makes sense to do that, even though I love him as a cocky heel. It's just, he knows he's good, and he is good. But he lost, but he had a good run. He had the title for about, 3.5 months? You know, 4 months. That's fine. You know, I'm okay with that. That's good. The Royal Rumble event itself, though, was lackluster. At this point, I mean, like every year, me and Ian complain about the Royal Rumble, how the winners stink every year, whether you're pushing Roman Reigns down our throats, you know, or Batista, which was one of the biggest wastes ever when Daniel Bryan should have won. It's just, they're really just not, they don't usually listen to what the fans want. However, this year, the difference with the Royal Rumble was that there wasn't like a clear front runner or winner. There was rumors, but it still was like, it could be like two or three different people that would have made sense, especially since now you have the brand split, which makes it even better because now you can have a guy fighting for the title on Raw or SmackDown, which was one of the reasons why I'm glad they did that. But just a comment on the Rumble, the middle of the Rumble, nothing happened. It was great in the beginning because you had Braun Strowman come out at number of 7 or 8. And then Braun Strowman's the real deal. He's a big man, which you've seen big men before, but he has the charisma. He's developing very well. I really like what he's been doing, and he was the monster that you thought he was going to stay there forever, but they had to really probably get him out of there before they got, like, you know, Brock and Goldberg in there, too many big guys. You know, you got to protect them somewhat. So Baron Corbin eliminated Braun Strowman. They're on different brands. Don't entirely agree with that.
I don't mind it. I think Corbin is pretty good right now, but he's still a little bit ways to go in my opinion, but I didn't mind that. However, we have to stop with Roman Reigns. We just have to stop. He's been in the final four, but not the final two, if not winning the last, what, four Royal Rumbles? The experiment has not worked. You already wasted a Royal Rumble win on it, and a WrestleMania main event with Brock Lesnar. You already wasted that. And they didn't have enough confidence in that they had to have Seth Rollins come in and cash it in, because they knew putting the belt on Reigns would have been a disaster. So they've tried to do it, put the belt on him later. Nothing. Fans don't care. It's over. At least as a face. Now, as a heel, that's something different. If the fans will then change that we don't care energy, or you're trying to push it down our throats enemy to, all right, now you're a heel, we're supposed to boo you. But then you can get into that X-Pac heat territory where it's not heel heat, it's we just don't want to see you at all on our TV heat. And yes, there is kayfabe, but most of the fans nowadays are not kayfabe fans. They're smarks. They know it's a work. So it's tough. But they teased a fight with The Undertaker somehow, because they allowed him to come out 30th. By the way, he came out 30th after he had fought earlier in the night and lost. Lost fighting for the title. So how come he gets to be in the Royal Rumble match? Again, this is why the fans don't like it. He comes in at 30. This disappoints everyone. What if that was AJ Styles that came in 30th? AJ wasn't even in the Rumble. And you can make the argument that maybe he should have been in there instead. At least get some of his heat back or whatever. But whatever, that's fine. But the fact that he's the final two again bothers me. It just does. I'm sorry. It's just, he's not a moneymaker. He's not. They tried for 3 years. It just has not worked out. So he eliminates Undertaker. You're probably going to see an Undertaker, maybe an Undertaker freaking Roman Reigns match at WrestleMania. That would be awful, especially if Roman Reigns won. He doesn't deserve it. People are saying maybe you're going to have Cena fight the Undertaker, maybe. But at least at this point, though, it's still up in the air. But the bad news is that before the match, I thought that Bray Wyatt would have been a great candidate to win it. He needs the rub. After starting out the first 6 or so months with volcanic sort of heat and people really getting into the character, they have him lose almost every single fucking feud he was in, whether it was Daniel Bryan, Chris Jericho. Chris Jericho was the only one he won. He loses to Cena. He loses to The Undertaker. It's hard to think of the ones he actually won. I thought, okay, this is sort of a resurgence on SmackDown with him and Harper, and now with Randy Orton, who has had a great he's been great teaming with the Wyatts. Let's give it to Bray. Have him run with the ball. But they had Orton win it instead. He eliminated Roman Reigns. So the rumors now that it'll be Bray Wyatt somehow getting the title at the Elimination Chamber match and fighting Orton at WrestleMania. I don't hate the idea, but I don't love it. Just because if you're going to give him the WrestleMania treatment, Bray, why not go the full 9 yards and give him the Royal Rumble treatment as well? That's just my argument. Randy Orton's won the Royal Rumble before. He's a, 10-time champ or whatever. He doesn't need the Royal Rumble win. At this point, you should only have guys winning it that need that push. Either the guy that the fans are totally behind, 100%, the premier star, which could be someone like an AJ Styles next year, you know, either do that or give it to someone that really needs it. And I don't think Orton is either. I just don't. So it wasn't as bad as the last couple of years of Rumble, but it wasn't great either. Again, in the middle, nothing really happened. Good start, decent finish. As long as Reigns didn't win it, I'm happy. Short Q&A time on the CU podcast. All right. This is from at Eric Rigsby. He just says, the JonTron interview. Okay. So, John Safari, also known as JonTron, who I haven't spoken to since, I think, Con Bravo 2013, which works into this. I'm not just name dropping it. It works into this conversation. So JonTron's been pretty vocal politically the past few months. I think he did a Breitbart interview, which is that alt-right? It's definitely right-wingish, if not alt-right. He's been starting to be vocal. He's been vocal in the past Then someone
like tells him, John, don't say shit politically on Twitter. You have too many followers. Then people, you know, leave him alone. Then he says something again. But this time he's just going all in. He did an interview with, I guess, someone who's alt-right, Sargon of Akkad. I've seen him around. He's one of these guys that gained prominence. A lot of these guys gained prominence with Gamergate, being pro-Gamergate, and they got a following by being sort of the opposite of the quote-unquote SJW voice. So I didn't read this interview or listen to. I guess I did a stream where they talked about politics in Syria. I did see a back and forth between Peanut Butter Gamer and JonTron on Twitter. They got into a spat about stuff, and then politics got brought into it. I guess he wants me to just comment on, like, in general. You can say whatever you want politically. It's just you have to be careful, obviously, how it damages your YouTube career. If you want to take that risk, go for it. I mean, I thought about it myself, whether I should talk about politics more or social stuff, and how much of my current fan base I'm going to piss off. You know, even if you're trying to be sort of even-keeled, someone's going to get pissed off because you're not going far enough in one direction or the other. So at some point, it's almost like you have to take a side. You know, I hate to say that. In this environment, social media is obviously the worst place on the planet to talk about politics, though. I mean, social media should be sharing GIFs and cat pictures and you know, and just snarky replies to, like, trailers and shit. Like, to me, politics, it's tough to discuss politics on social media, and then you say that, and our fucking president got partially elected for discussing politics on social media. Which, again, that's a whole other conversation. That's a conversation for the upcoming PatCast, where I can talk about this stuff more freely without half my audience jumping down my throat, or the other half saying you're not going far enough in condemning or supporting this stuff. But that's where you're at. So, I mean, it comes down to artist versus art. If a YouTuber's out there that says stuff you disagree with, does that mean you should stop watching their videos or following them? I don't know. It's up to you. You know, it's not like Roman Polanski, who freaking sodomized a girl in the 70s and still, you know, and Hollywood still likes the guy. You know what I mean? Like, he's still, he can't come back to the U.S., though. But, I mean, like, people still think that's okay. Woody Allen has had a very questionable relationship with younger people in his life. I'm putting that as very delicately as I could. And he's still revered. People still love his works. You know, his Netflix specials and his movies. People watch him. Frank still loves Woody Allen. You know, Frank will still watch Roman Polanski's Chinatown. So can you separate the art from the artist? If not, then whatever. You can't. But we're at a point now where you have to, because everyone, whether it's actors, people on TV, YouTubers, are very vocal about this stuff. It's become not more toxic. No, I think it's just become more... more of a lightning rod now that Trump's in office, that you have more people speaking up, you have these harsher sort of diverging opinions, where you're going to see this. This is going to happen. So you can either ignore social media, which I recommend people do, honestly, because when I go to social media now, half the time it's political stuff where I follow politics, but that's not why I go on social media. If I'm going to go that, I'm going to go on a site like, I don't know, like Real Clear Politics, which is sort of a compilation of political articles from all over, left, right, middle, it's everything. I'd rather do that versus what's trending on social media right now. Who are we going to boycott? What company are we going to boycott today because they supported one person or another? That's fucking garbage. That's meaningless in the grand scheme of things, to try to keep track of that stuff or follow that. That is there today, gone tomorrow. That's nothing. But hey, if you want to follow, you know, you want to stop following someone on Twitter because you don't agree with their politics? Of course, that's why it's there. But to not look at their art, well, you might as well then not watch half the people on TV or don't see half the movies. Because I guarantee you, even though Hollywood leans heavily liberal, there's people out there that are not going to agree with, musicians, artists, whatever. So people you don't agree with politically. People in your life, people, there's friends, I guarantee you out there listening, there's a friend that doesn't agree with you politically. Either you know that or they're keeping it from you. Family members. There's family members I don't agree with politically. There's people that swing too left. There's people that swing too right for me in my life. Good friends. People that I can talk to for hours that we always end up having arguments about. But you know what? I respect the people because I like them. I like their personalities. I like they're good people. And I think that's what you have to remember.
Now it's becoming a podcast. You can agree with or disagree with someone politically, but what are they as a person? How do they treat other people that you know? That's what really matters. At the end of the day, that's a new Pat term, that's what defines us, how you treat other people, how you conduct yourself. Political opinions can be varied. They can be even extreme in some cases. But I will take someone with an extreme political position if they treat everyone like fucking gold versus someone with political opinions I agree with that treats other people like trash. I don't want that person in my life. Be a good person. Let's all just be better to each other. Schmaltzy, yes, but that's what I truly believe in. You start just treating each other with the same respect that you want. Sort of these weird political disagreements that get blown up, I think they will be shrunk more and more naturally if we can stop with this fucking tribalism. Oh my God, is that it for a CU podcast for Tuesday, February 1st, 2017? No, it's Wednesday. I'm recording on a Wednesday. I'm late. It's Wednesday. Oh my God, I don't have to go back and record the beginning of the show. Did I say Tuesday, February 1st? It's Wednesday, February 1st. And again, I'll be at the SoCal Retro Gaming Expo this weekend in Ontario, California. Woo! The Android app is out. Woo! iOS one's out. Woo! That's good as well. The book is back in stock at ultimatenes.com. Check out Ian's GoFundMe and for updates on his health at thepunkeffect.com/Ian. And hey, if you want to advertise on the CU Podcast, send an email to cupodcast@thepunkeffect.com. So, I was Pat Contry, I guess, at some point. I'm exhausted. I gotta go eat some dinner. I think the doorbell just rang. I think that's my Uber Eats right there, actually. Should I boycott Uber Eats? It's too convenient right now. I'm sorry. All right, I'll see you later.